right. Well, it is 11 o'clock, so I'm going to start this baby. This is, I forget which session this is, but I have to tell all the people in MP3 land. This is session 132, Bridging Mormonism and Popular Culture, with your host, Stephen Carter. I am going to present first. I'm going to be talking about comics, Book of Mormon comics, which actually have roots all the way back to 1850, if you can believe it. And then, should we just go in order? Then next will be Jacob Bender, who is a doctoral candidate at the University of Iowa. And once Jacob Bender and I attended the same low concert and had no idea that we were both in the same room, even though there were about, I don't know, what would you say?
Like 100 people there.
Like 100 people there. It was a great concert, though.
It was. It was dark, though, so.
Yeah, it was dark.
My excuse.
And then Geralyn Hassel Poole will be next. She is probably the most famous of all of us. In fact, I really have to.
There you go.
I just got this from Geralyn Hassel Poole's table. It says, Chieko Okazaki is my spirit animal.
Oh.
It's only $5. Get one. And then Ethan Sproat is going to come. He's not actually here yet, but he is a PhD in composition and rhetoric, and he is a newly hired assistant professor at UVU and regularly assembles the Life, the Universe, and Everything conference down at BYU, even though it's not BYU anymore. So we'll start with me. I'm going to start with George Reynolds and CCA Christensen, who put together a book called Lessons from the Life of Nephi, and it was originally printed serially in the Juvenile Instructor in 1891. So the engravings, which is kind of what you see here, they were actually originally paintings that he did, and they were turned into these black and white engravings for the Juvenile Instructor. And they looked a lot better in color. They look kind of awful here. But what would happen is that each page would have one of these pictures up, and it would have a little caption down at the bottom. So, for example, this caption reads, "Our lesson teaches these truths, that all things are known unto the Lord, the future as well as the past, and that he reveals to his servants, the prophets, many things before they come to pass, that his name may be glorified in their accomplishment. Further, that when a people turn from him and become wicked and corrupt, he does not punish them until he has sent his messengers to warn them of the danger in their evil ways." So, I'll show you the rest of these. Where's my moose? Here it is. So there was... Oh, come on. Is this going to happen every time?
Yes.
I don't want this to happen every time. Okay.
Just do this then. Quick, Steve.
Okay, so here's Lehi and his family going out of Jerusalem with their very strange-looking camels and their... Did this really happen? Did they really have these little pods up on top of their camels that they would ride around in? Apparently. I guess I'd leave Jerusalem if I had a little camel pod to ride in. And then here's Laman and Lemuel and Sam and Nephi escaping from Jerusalem after having stolen the brass plates after committing murder. And then here's a really interesting one. This is where kind of Catholic symbolism and Mormon symbolism come together, because this is, the angel showing Nephi the vision of Mary and the baby Jesus, but, you know, you would think it would be Catholic if you looked at that. But it's very Mormon. It came out of 1891. Let's head to the next one. So that's what a comic book, a Book of Mormon comic book, looked like in 1891. Now we're going to fast forward to 1947, and we're going to go to the Deseret News. Oh, don't do that to me. How did I do this last time? Because now they're JPEGs, and so they don't like to show up. How can I open this? Open it with paint. See what happens. There we go. All right.
this.
Okay. So, back in 1947, John Philip Dalby, and I got most of this from Artist Partial's wonderful blog, Keep a Pitchin' In. Stories from the Book of Mormon was written by and illustrated by John Philip Dalby, and it was printed serially in the Deseret News until from January 1st, 1947, weekly until May 1948. And then after that, it just sort of showed up whenever he had the time. And the last comic appeared in August 8th of 1953. So actually, these were so popular that early in its run, the Deseret News offered little scrapbook covers that you could cut these out and put them inside and make your own Book of Mormon comic book that you could read during church. So it's really an interesting progression from what we had before. We had sort of those stilted, folk artsy feel approaches to the Book of Mormon. And now you can see a real cartoony feel starting to come into thinking about how to represent the Book of Mormon. So, for example, one of my favorite things about this is this Tower of Babel. This is a story of Jared just as they're leaving. And it reminds me a lot of Hieronymus Bosch's stuff with their kind of screwy architecture. And you have, like, the lightning and this strange, like, tentacle that seems to be coming up out of the earth, like some sort of evil is. So really interesting sort of symbolic approach, and then you can see the evil little silhouettes back there. And also take a look at these people. They're sort of stunted and sort of cavemanish with their strange beards that sort of go off in all sorts of different directions. And I really should have done something about this. I'm hoping this would paint again. And then we also have the story of And so we head deeper into Ether, and as you can see, we don't have pretty people at all here. This is a real departure from what we're used to, you know, in the past, like, three decades, where everybody's really pretty. But his Book of Mormon's characters were kind of primitive. And look at his gigantic sword there and his strange face. And they even have violence, which usually doesn't show up in the Deseret News. Let's see if there are any other good ones. I may just give up on this.
Is it opening in the wrong program?
Well, it just has a strange way of opening up. And then here's where Cory Antimer and Shiz meet in combat. There's a little bit of violence there. Some very strange stuff, but you can see the sort of blasted landscape that's going on, and some more sort of cavemanish references here. So this was kind of how Philip Dalby approached it, and it was a very unique approach, and it hasn't actually been done like that since then.
Stephen, is there any attempt at humor at all, like with you and Jet? You know, you was he doing anything like that?
There is no attempt at humor in stories from the Book of Mormon. In fact, you can see from the text that it sticks really close to the tone and the often the actual Book of Mormon text. And so, no, it was all very serious, but it still made strides forward in sort of going into the comic book look. So now we're going to go forward a couple more years.
So are there books of this?
No.
So it was just published in the papacy.
Yeah, yeah. It was only in the Deseret News, and then Artis was kind enough to go through and scan a lot of them, and they're up on her blog. So that's really the only place that you can find them. I don't know if they're even under copyright or anything. Maybe somebody can make a quick buck by putting them on there or something. Let's see, where did this... Okay, so then we fast forward to... I don't remember when this was. I should look. 1947. Oh, we're still in 1947. This was the Herald House's printing of a Book of Mormon comic book called The First Americans. And amazingly, there is absolutely nothing on the internet about this book except for this image. And you'll find out that you can find it at, like, Princeton, the Graceland University Library, and BYU. That's it. I have no idea what's inside of it. But it is apparently about the Book of Mormon, because it says so on the side, a pictorial version of the Book of Mormon. So that's the really interesting thing, was that the RLDS Church was the first Mormonish church to, in Latter-day Saint tradition, to put out an entire book being a comic book of the Book of Mormon. So now let's go ahead to the LDS version. Let's see. Just open it for Pete's sake. It's really not going to open it up if I have a PDF. All I want you to do... Well, everything... It's the PDF. Look at that. It doesn't have Acrobat. Hey! Okay. I hope this... Did you
get it for it? He's keeping it clean. He's not swearing.
The love of the teachers.
I can't believe that it wouldn't have. Let's see what happens. Just... Do it. Oh, it's converting the Book of Mormon. Okay, well, I'm just going to tell you about it. So there's an old version and a new version. And I may just have to show it to you using my little things. So there were two versions. The first version, you know, took over the entire computer. It's almost there. So the old version was the one that I grew up with. And this... this didn't work out. Okay, think in your mind. There was a time when there was a Book of Mormon reader and it had that sort of fabric cover and it had the little stripes of the people who look like Egyptian engravings or something. And then as you went through that, you would find... let's see. I know. Oh, there's the old reader cover. Yes! This is funny. When I was trying to find this, I could not find much of it on the internet at all. And I couldn't find a PDF version of this so that I could actually read it and go back to, you know, my childhood. I had to get this from a store in Idaho for like $30. They just soaked me for it. So this is the old one. And this was a really interesting time to be reading Book of Mormon comic books, because it had very different styles as you went from story to story. So you probably remember this cartoon modern style. It kind of felt like Sleeping Beauty, with its really strong lines and flat colors, and it felt like Sleeping Beauty to me. And then you also had the verisimilitude. So it sort of bounced back and forth. And to this day, I still think of Nephi as having kind of this curved nose. I don't remember if I have Nephi in here. No, I don't see Nephi. That's too bad. Oh, maybe this is
a different artist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had different artists as they went along. And so The really interesting thing of when you compare the Old Book of Mormon Reader with the New Book of Mormon Reader is that the Old Book of Mormon Reader has a number of different styles as it goes along, and the New Book of Mormon Readers has a very unified style, and it all looks like that. So it's very verisimilitude, very little room for the symbolism that was in Dalby's, very little room for kind of the fun colors and kind of the play that's going on. Hi, Phyllis, thanks for coming. So I'm going to show you kind of a comparison of what happened between these two this is my beer tour. Okay, so this is the old one where Abinadi had a beard. This is a new one where Abinadi loses his beard. And you may have also noticed that he gained one more thing. He got a shirt. We had no more manly male chests in the new version of the Book of Mormon Reader, which I find fascinating. Maybe a little disappointing.
It's correlated now.
Yeah. What were the two dates of the publications?
Oh, I think it was 1973 and 2002. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Okay, so let's take this quick tour. So here's Alma. Alma had a beautiful, lush beard in the first one. And then in the second one, he was divested of his beard, and he was so ashamed that he hid behind a plant. And here's Alma the Younger, who had followed in his father's footsteps and had kept his beard. And he even had an awesome Nephite headband. But as you can see, he was about 16, apparently, when he appeared in the 2002 version, and hadn't quite learned how to wear a cape yet. How to work this? Here's an interesting one. Amaron, who was Mormon's mentor, he has a cool hat and a beard, and he lost both. I don't know, would you want that guy for a mentor? I'd prefer the guy with the cool hat. So here is Alma and Amulek, and as you can see, they both lost their beards as well, and Amulek turned blonde. I don't know, maybe he was Swedish or something. And here's a really interesting one. This is the brother of Jared. So Jared, as you can see, he kept his beard. I'm trying to figure out why this would be. Why would the brother of Jared keep his beard? Maybe it was because he had this awesome square beard at the beginning. And let's see who else I've got here. Okay, so here's Captain Moroni with his awesome title of Liberty. And then he got a stick from his kids and he said, can you, tie something on? I don't know. Would you follow that guy into battle? Come on, guys! Let's go! So, this is really interesting. The one guy who actually gained a beard was Ether. I don't know why. It's one of the strange mysteries.
His hair's a lot nicer, too. It's
yeah, you're right.
Very conditioned.
He's not living in a cave at that point either. So that's the one exception was Ether. And then there's Helaman as he leads his warriors into battle, and they're like, are you sure this guy's over 20 years old? Is he any older than we are? It's also interesting to see the depiction of violence in between the two. This is the older one, or the newer one, and the older one. So the really interesting thing about the newer one to me is here we have a little splash of liquid red, and we also have red beneath Laban's head. But in both cases, it's not blood, it's wine, and it's, you know, his little back scarf or whatever.
So he's praying.
Yeah, it does look like he's praying. Oh my gosh, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
So, lots of really interesting changes happened. Oh, and there's Nephi and Lehi, the second ones. And since this is the first time that they showed up in the Book of Mormon Reader, then I don't have anything to compare them to. Oh, and there's... This is one of those interesting changes. This is Moroni, the last Moroni, and this is his ninja version.
Yeah.
Or something. But maybe it's a nod to verisimilitude because he was the last Nephite, right? So he had to cut his own hair.
With a bowl.
Yeah, like the sword. Anyway, oh, there's the new Book of Mormon Stories cover. Oh, that was one really interesting thing. This is Ether teaching, and I noticed the echo with the Noah's preaching. Definitely a visual echo there. Okay, that's the end of the beard tour. Okay, so now we're going to go forward to The Golden Plates by Mike Allred. Now, Mike Allred, oh, for Pete's sake, it is a PDF.
You should just download. Do you have internet? You can just install it.
Well, I've got this one, which is a JPEG. This is still sad. Okay, you don't get to see as much of Mike Allred as I want you to, but oh well. I wonder if all my stuff's in PDF. That'd be awful. Okay, so Mike Allred is a big name in mainstream Mormon comics. He did the Daredevil. He did Madman. He did... he's doing something recently, like Green Lantern or something. What is he doing now? He did the X-Force. And he made history when he threw it all away. He had made a ton of money on X-Force, and he decided, I'm going to do the Book of Mormon. I'm going to make the Book of Mormon from beginning to end. I'm going to call it the Golden Plates. And when Meridian Magazine interviewed him, he said, the Book of Mormon in and of itself is thrilling beyond anything I've ever read. So the entertainment takes care of itself. That being the case, a clear visual missionary tool is my goal. That's what he had in mind, a missionary tool. It'd be great if even just one person turned to the full force of the scripture because of this project that I'm doing. So he published 3 volumes, and I really wish I remembered to bring it with me. It's beautiful. If you ever get a chance to buy one of these, they're gorgeous. There's Ethan Sproat. I am going to dock you 10% on your grade for being late, Professor Sproat.
I'm going to sit in the back.
So they're beautiful books. They're gorgeously produced. He's a top-rank artist, and his wife did the color, and I feel awful for not knowing her name right off the top of my head.
That is awful.
I am terrible. But she's an award-winning colorist. So, yeah, I feel bad. So they made 3 volumes, and they started with Nephi, and they just went book by book. And the really interesting thing is he did everything. So at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, it's okay to make a comic book about it because you've got Nephi, he's doing stuff, he's like killing people, he's stealing stuff, and he's the good guy. And, and so they get through that, and that's great. And then they get to the Book of Omni. Do you remember what happens in the Book of Omni?
Yeah.
Like a dozen people say, well, the end.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
He totally illustrates that.
Wow.
And I had it on PDF, but I'm just not seeing it here. So it really bogs down. And you can see this little tiny print. And in most of the pages, it's like 2/3 print to 1/3 image. And so it really gets bogged down. And when you decide you're going to read it, it's almost like reading the Book of Mormon itself, because you're kind of going, It's like reading the Book of Mormon in Comic Sans. So it's a beautiful piece of work, but it just didn't work out. And in 2005, he put out the last issue, which was the Sermon of Jacob. He illustrated the Sermon of Jacob. And this comes from this last volume. And the really interesting thing is, this is portraying what happened to the Lamanites. So they were supposed to have gotten, like, a skin cursing. So the interesting thing about this is he doesn't consider it like and all over pigment change, they kind of get like diseased, and they get sort of mottled, and they start using these awful little tools and scratching themselves. So, and Mike Allred's thing was very humorless as well. There's one attempt at humor where they say, and we found animals that we'd never seen before, and they're like scratching the big mosquito bites. Okay, the next one is, I'm going to give you, so there was supposed to be another Book of Mormon comic. It was supposed to be by Chris Hermendinger, who wrote the Ten Issues Among the Nephites, and Sal DeLuto, who was a huge name in comics, was supposed to illustrate it, but it was in a PDF format, so it never made it to the computer. You can totally see if you can make your PDF work,
because they can't see this. So.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to go to From the Dust. So let me open up From the Dust.
I have one question about this dude that you still have up, the leprosy guys.
Okay.
So you said it was a marvelous work, but super boring to read it, right?
Yeah, it was.
So when you say it was a marvelous work, you meant visually?
Visually. It's gorgeous. Visually, it's beautiful.
But it didn't work because it didn't hold anybody's attention, because who wants to read it, right?
Yeah, that was the difficulty.
So you could look at the pictures as a picture book.
Uh-huh.
And it was okay, but they didn't ever finish. They only made it halfway through or something.
They made it about halfway through the Book of Jacob.
And they're done.
Yeah.
That's like real life, so.
It also. That's where the permit happens. Okay. So here's Michael Mercer's. This is the Book of Mormon. Just
really?
To let you know. This is the Book of Mormon. This is Nebuchadnezzar.
My boy would read this.
Yeah, it's awesome. This is like. He describes it as if Disney got a hold of the Book of Mormon. It looks a little bit more like Don Bluth to me, but I can see where it's going. It kind of feels like the Dark Crystal to me.
Yeah.
But so this is what like everything looks like. Oh, did you screw it over?
Yeah. Oh, they have an administrator.
For Pete's
this
sake.
Isn't an administrator.
Okay, that's terrible.
It's not going to happen.
Okay, so this is Nebuchadnezzar. He's riding into Jerusalem on his pterodactyl, and he's going in to start the Book of Mormon into motion, because you remember that there was all kinds of political intrigue that was going on while Nephi was preaching, and there was all this wickedness, and so he actually starts it from Jerusalem history, and only slowly works his way into the actual Book of Mormon story. Let me bring up one more.
That'd be cool if it worked, though.
Okay, so here is another beautiful shot. I mean, you want to get this book because it's so beautiful. And it has such gorgeous like architecture and stuff. So if you look closely at this,
I can't see where my mouse is.
Oh, okay. Let's look closer.
That,
ooh.
Is that a cat?
Move up and down? Oh, come on. I am so computer illiterate.
Go away.
It's a good thing you don't have a job that puts you on a computer all day, right?
I know.
Where did all my stuff go?
We like the review. That was good.
Well, at least you're getting to see all that. All
right, I lost it. Okay, we're back. So this is Nephi and Lehi and his family leaving Jerusalem. And you can't quite tell, but Lehi is a jackal. This is really where it gets really interesting. The Book of Mormon becomes fuzzy. Lehi is a jackal. Sariah is a cat. And what happens when these two get together? Well, Nephi is a cat, and Laman is some kind of dog, and Lemuel is a pudgy dog. So apparently when a jackal and a cat get together, it's like you roll the dice and you say, what species is going to come out? But it's really a fascinating book, and it's gorgeous. And this is like poster art, and all of it looks like that.
Oh, wow.
So his first book, Volume 1, was 120 pages, which sounds awesome. The problem is there's only 16 pages of actual story. And the rest of it is like learning Hebrew, Bible history, how I made these characters. It's like DVD extras. So you only actually get 16 pages of actual story out of it. So, but what he's planning to do is put out a whole bunch of, like a comic book. So one issue comes out each month that's like 24 pages, and we get through the Book of Mormon like that. Did it work?
Almost. You can pull up new stuff. Almost.
Oh, okay. So now I'm going to go to my favorite one. I don't know why.
Yay, look at this.
Okay, well, I'm to this now. I appreciate you trying. Okay. Let's see what I got here. So now I'm going to go into iPlates, which is my comic book.
Woo-hoo!
I brought a hard copy so that you could see it because the PDF doesn't work. So far we have two volumes, and this is a completely different animal, which I will show you.
Is it a jackal or a dog or a fat dog?
No, we use people.
Okay.
And it started out serialized in Sunstone, and we just put it like the last six pages. And it was a lot of fun to do because, let's see. Because what we did was we went in and we sort of fleshed out the backstory. So, for example, here we have Abinadi, and in the actual Book of Mormon, he shows up, preaches to King Noah, and dies. That's pretty much all we know about him. But we decided it would be a lot more fun if we brought him in at the beginning. So we started with Zenith, and he goes with the army to destroy the Lamanites, finds out that the Lamanites are people, then he tries to convince his army to not destroy the Lamanites, and the army ends up destroying itself. And so, you know, a whole bunch of people die anyway. And then he decides that he's going to go back and reclaim the land peacefully. The Lamanite king has other ideas, but here is Zenith as he's going off with his people to go reclaim the land of Nephi. And as you can see, he brought names, Yezophat, trade, farmer, name, Sarjex, trade, smith, name, coriander, trade, literary critic. Because you need one of those on every pioneer trip, right? And then we have name, Abinadi, trade, prophet. And then they start laughing at him, and they say, you know, who wants him along? And then Abinadi sneaks along with them by putting on a gigantic afro wig so that nobody can recognize him. So this is kind of a completely new approach to it because it's funny. And, did I bring the funny stuff? I don't remember if I brought the funny stuff. But we integrate a lot of pop culture into it. For example, in this one, when Alma is preaching to the people at the Waters of Mormon, if you look really close, you can see a Viking, Cusco from The Emperor's New Groove, and Darth Vader. Some people may feel that this is sacrilegious, but in my own humble view, it just shows that the gospel is for everybody. Okay. So anyway, that's a basic history of Book of Mormon comics, and there are two basic trends that I've seen. One is from the very serious and sticking close to the text to really going out on a limb and doing amazing things like making the Book of Mormon prophets fuzzy and making them into animals, and also getting pop culture stuff into it, sort of bringing, like, the Book of Mormon was written for our day, right? Yep. And so with this, with these new approaches, I kind of feel like it's interacting with the Book of Mormon in an appropriate way, in that we're bringing our own experience to the Book of Mormon and making it into something that will resonate with today's audience. And the other thing that's really good for Book of Mormon comics, and I hope that it helps more people than just us, is Kickstarter. We ran a Kickstarter that was very successful, and it funded our new book. And I hope that there will be a lot more of that stuff, and that we can have a lot more independent stuff, because that was what destroyed Mike Allred, was that he funded the entire thing himself, and nobody and not enough people bought it, and it, like, destroyed the entire enterprise. So hopefully Kickstarter will help a lot more people who are. I'm done now. Thank you very much. All right, Jacob, I hope you don't have any PDFs, because if you do, too bad. I wonder how many
just go on
presentations for PDFs. Portable document file that should be able to go anywhere.
Yeah, you have the reader installed, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Jump on there. Awesome.
Need to get on the interwebs. Go fast. Yes. Yeah, I think it's over. All right. We're not going to watch that one.
Looks sad.
Picture of the band, so we have a reference point. All right. Hi, I'm Jacob. Nice to meet y'all.
Hi, Jacob.
What's up? I got my master's here at the U, so that's really nice feedback. The Duluth, Minnesota-based indie trio Low, that's them, Alan Sparhawk, Mimi Parker, and their current bassist, Steve Garrington. Are typically noted, when they're noted at all, they're typically noted for 2 points. One, they're kind of known as that really slow, quiet band. One that half facetiously coined the term slowcore, due to their propensity to produce very minimalistic music at a deliberate pace and hushed volume. And two, that the husband and wife duo here, Alan and Mimi, are practicing members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Point one, that they're a very slow, quiet band, has not been strictly true for about 4 albums now. When we crossed into the 21st century, they started plugging in their amplifiers. Although their slow embracing of the distortion pedal has not harmed their minimalist ethos, nor their critical love, nor the devotion to their cult following. Point two, that their LDS tends to only come up in passing. It's not like the Killers and Brandon Flowers or anything. And it only tends to come up to explain such very oblique lines as, for example, they have a song called Missouri that opens with the line, "Oh, speak to me, Adam and Eve," which is something, LDS folks will pick up and just sounds like more cryptic nonsense to other casual listeners. And it's off a 1999 album called Secret Name. Nevertheless, these very discreet LDS references are few and scattered across their 20-year 10-LP discography. And though band leader Alan Sparhawk stated in a 2009 interview that, quote, "Our spiritual beliefs encompass our whole life and understanding of who we are and what we do," Low is not a proselyting group. You're not going to find pass-along cards at their shows or anything. Few, if any, would call them a Mormon band, just Mormons who are in a band. Nevertheless, I would like to explore how point two bears on point one. That is, I suspect that Lowe's minimalism and Mormonism goes hand in hand, and not just for the handy alliteration of that statement. Specifically, I argue that it is Lowe's minimalism, their fearlessness in embracing the silences between notes, that allows Lowe to interact with the very things that can't be said, that can't be represented, the unspeakable thing that the piece would surpass the understanding that is outside discourse, and that is most responsible for Mormon spiritual conversion. Low does not fear the silence. Silence for them is not nihilistic void, but where the true religious experience lies. In Corinthians, Paul writes, "The kingdom is not in word, but in power." Just as Low's music is religious, not in its words, but in the experience of it. Low's music doesn't try to speak the unspeakable, in other words, but instead creates a silent space within its music that calls attention to the silence. It is this ethos of silence that I argue is
quintessentially LDS, more than many of the LDS themed art currently extant. Let me explain. Paul Signac, the new impressionist painter, is attributed to have said, quote, "The anarchist artist is not the one who creates anarchist paintings." That is, it's not the artist's it's not the painting's content that renders it anarchistic, but rather the manner in which the painting style violates conventions. For example, a Soviet Greco-Roman propagandist mural may be radical in its politics by our standards, but yet utterly conservative in its very traditional form. Similarly, a Mormon artist may produce art that is purportedly LDS in content, but I argue devoid of that LDS spiritual ethos and execution. Hence, we have my dad listening to Michael McLean's Forgotten Girls Every Christmas in the mawkish, sentimental style of Broadway musicals, which is, as we already know, is a style so conventional, so formulaic, that the hacks behind South Park were able to ape into Tony's comedic effect with the mocking Book of Mormon musical. Irony McLean is Signac's faux anarchist. That's probably the first time that sentence has ever been uttered. He's LDS in content, but not in form. Low, I argue, while rarely LDS in content, is distinctly LDS in a form that Trey and Matt have yet to copy. Now, certainly there are a few explicitly LDS groups I'm aware of, which is admittedly a small list. I'm open to recommendations. That are trying to do anything remotely similar to Low. They're very much a singularity of their own. The closest act similar to them I can think of is, tellingly, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Let me give an example. In the days before CDs were standard in cars, I recall having to hit the seek button on my car's cassette tape player, find the next song if you're a music teacher. And what the player would do is it would find the next empty space on the tape devoid of music and assume that was the space between songs. And this feature usually worked well, except for the Tab Choir cassette that I only played on Sundays. It was O Divine Redeemer, if anyone, and you remember that album. And that arrangement is so full of silent lulls that my tape player kept stopping in the middle of that song. To the point that I just learned to actually enjoy the song and quit trying to skip it. As C.S. Lewis wrote in Screwtape Letters, and this is a paraphrase, "In heaven, all is either music or silence. It's the devil who prefers noise." So I find it interesting that Low is a musical group that likewise embraces silences. It is this embracing of the silence of the space between notes, between words, that for me sets apart both Low and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir's distinctly LDS form. This is because Mormons, supposedly unlike many Christian denominations, we should not be biblical fundamentalists. You know, it's an article of faith that the Bible is correct only insofar as it is translated correctly, which implies that the Bible's words often fail to transmit meaning correctly, as frankly all words fail to do that. Our own Book of Mormon is filled with laments of the inadequacy of language. Our weakness in writing is Moroni's lament in Ether 12. They repeatedly say that words cannot communicate even a hundredth part of what we are trying to convey. Of the imperfections inherent even in the Book of Mormon texts. And Nephi himself writes, quote, "Neither am I mighty in writing, like in speaking, for when a man speaks by the power of the Holy Ghost and carries it into the hearts of the children of men." Which clearly delineates how spirit is often communicated in spite of the words, not because of them. And ones who sat through a really dry high council speak, that's exactly what I'm talking about, right? Sometimes you still feel the spirit, but it has nothing to do with what they're battling about. Now, the Holy Ghost accompanies words, yes, but it is not contained in them. It is a still small voice, as we often teach, that often requires complete silence to be detected. Though also, according to the DNC, it oftentimes maketh my bones to quake while it maketh manifest, as the spirit grows in amplification to overpower all else, much like a Motap chorus, or some of the later music of Low. Missionaries today are trained to preach the gospel and, if necessary, use words. At least so said Elder Holland when he was quoting St. Francis, which implies that words are the least relevant part of spiritual conversion. The trend in our recent programs has been towards less speaking, fewer discussions, but the spirit does not multiply many words, according to Nephi, since words just get in the way of spiritual experience. In Mormonism, the spirit is a thing outside discourse, beyond words, beyond utterance, that exists in the silent spaces where words fail to mean. I want to give an example of that by playing the very first song off their very first record, called, released in 1994, it was called I Could Live in Hope.
And the song, appropriately enough, is entitled Words. I just want us to listen to the first couple minutes of it, and then I want to do a reading of the video. I hope this, is the volume all the way up on this?
I don't know, I'll try it out.
Okay, there it is. It's a very quiet song. So I'm going to let that keep playing in the background while I just point out a few elements. So one can see actual words make up very little of the song Words, or of course, the words are the least part of the experience. The arrangement is simple to the point of austere. The strange verses communicate a mood more than a clear meaning. The most discernible line in the first verse is too many words, which expresses the desire to be free of the cluttering words that impede the religious aesthetic experience of silence. And the chorus line of, "And I can hear 'em," acknowledges the presence of words without ascribing the meaning, thus keeping the words out of the way of the unspeakable beyond utterance. In the video, that's a Frozen over Lake Superior, by the way. In the video, the band members stand far apart from each other in a large room that calls attention to the spaces between them. The song alone fills the empty spaces between the band members, just as the notes fill the unbridgeable gap between word and meaning, just as the silences bridge the gaps between the notes themselves. As many music critics have repeatedly noted, the silences are as integral to Lowe's songs as the instrumentation. In fact, arguably, the silence is where Lowe's music actually lies. As mentioned earlier, Lowe would go on in their later albums to embrace the distortion pedal and the amplifier, as well as strings, horns, piano, and even electronica. They actually get some pretty complex arrangements in their 21st century stuff. But as more competent music reviewers and myself have noted, Lowe's ultimate increase in volume, while perhaps a surprise, was not necessarily a shock, for there had always been a menacing feel of violence lingering just beneath silence. But I'm not even sure violence is the right word for it. Violence, again, implies a nihilistic threat to the self, and as Lowe made clear on their second album, you can't trust violence. Now, one can feel a nihilistic threat from the all-consuming silence, to be sure, but only if one believes that silence is equivalent to the void. Silence is not where the threat lies, but the redemption for Lowe. The words were the threat. It was the words that separated us from each other. It's outside the words where one becomes reconciled, at one, with the silence that contains the groanings beyond utterance. Lowe treats the silence as not as empty, but full, even as redemptive, inviting the audience to engage directly with atonement, actively, directly, outside image, outside mediation, symbol, semiotics, and discourse. Thank you.
Just do an interpretive dance of the memes.
I will say that all these PhDs here at the table make me a little intimidated, but have a BS to compete. And BS will compete. I have a bachelor's degree in art.
Nice.
With a minor in math.
Whoa.
Right?
Wow. You could totally beat me up.
Anyway. It says it's loading, so I thought this was a smart way to do this.
You can tell us more about you.
I'm a blogger with FMH. And I also blog at Rational Faith sometimes. I have admin access to surprisingly many progressive Mormon blogs. So I wield a lot of power there. And I'm a mother. I have 5 children. I just had a grandbaby born this year, my very first. I know. I'm way young for that. And
Oh, and she serves the missionary's candlestick salad.
I do.
You may have seen it on YouTube.
So let's see what else. I work as a graphic artist. I work from home. So I sit at a computer all day and yell at children to do things. I have 4 teenagers, and then I have a 6-year-old who's the worst decision I ever made in my life. She was a surprise. And I was 30, how old was I? 38 when she was born. So
she's hilarious, though.
She is hilarious. She's been raised by teenagers, so she... Okay. And so one of the things that I do... I'm not sure why this is... All right. Can you help me?
Sure.
I mean, I don't know what you can do. It says it's loading.
He's magic.
I can wave this around.
I thought for sure I wasn't going to have to use him.
Did yours use any thingies?
PowerPoint.
PowerPoint? I have no idea if it has PowerPoint.
It
probably
does. It doesn't have Adobe Reader on it.
Somebody remind me to sign out of my Google account when I'm done.
Use the same password in all those blogs.
But it's not Bonnie.
No, it's not.
There's no Carl.
Is all we've got.
Yeah.
Yes, she is.
I get around a lot online.
That's PowerPoint.
I don't need PowerPoint. I won't work in PowerPoint because it's a Google.
Maybe what we should do is have Ethan go, since we know we have PowerPoint, and by the time he's done, it should have loaded, right?
Maybe.
Is that a good idea?
What we probably should do is grab Miriam's laptop and just swap it around.
Okay. Let's have Ethan go while you guys figure that out.
On the same machine.
No, you're on this machine. They're on that machine.
All right.
That sound good?
Oh, wait, it just loaded.
Whoa!
Oh,
okay. Maybe I should stay up here.
They just
no, you can sit.
That
one's
cool.
How'd
you do that?
Okay.
I don't know how
that happened.
Good stuff.
Wait, you need a visual aid.
Now it's loading.
Oh, my goodness. I am a Mac user, so
yes,
I'm completely out of my depth.
Is it working at all?
It says it's loading again. But at least I'm in the book. So, all right.
So, do you have a year?
Yeah, we got Miriam's laptop.
All right. Ethan will go. and you go sit by that handsome couple and see if you can get it going.
I am going to sign
with the Google Docs.
Oh, sure, log me out immediately.
Stephen, don't you think this is an interesting display of Mormonism versus popular culture?
Mormonism versus technology. It's VGA.
It's VGA.
Screwed? We're screwed.
Great face.
Unless we have an adapter.
If anyone has a VGA Mac adapter, I don't like, I'm going to use my Mac. You have a VGA Mac adapter?
Yes,
I have a
Mac.
Thank you.
Bring it up to her.
May I borrow both?
Go back and sit by them. Get that ready.
Okay. So, pop culture, a little bit of background about myself. I don't know what Steven said about me other than make fun of me being late. Sorry about that. I have last year I finished a PhD in English rhetoric and composition at Purdue University. This last year I've been teaching a tenure track position in the Department of English at Utah Valley University. And I've never really done a Mormon studies thing in my life. But one of my master's degrees, the first one I got was in science fiction studies from the University of Liverpool, because I was that big of a geek. Seriously, sometimes when I get into like geek cred contests with other like con attending people and whatnot, I'm like, well, I have a master's degree in it, so. But then of course that's more useless than just a straight up English master's degree. And so I went back to school and got a master's degree in English rhetoric, and then I went and got the PhD in rhetoric and composition, and that's what I teach now, mostly tech writing, professional writing courses. But UVU saw the MA in science fiction studies on my CV, and they give me the science fiction classes. Oh, it's just pure candy. It's lovely. And so this project, when Stephen approached me, I percolated for a day or two, and then I knew what I wanted to talk about. Magic systems and a discourse of obedience. Magic systems are a quality of fantasy stories, you know, that have magic, how to explain them and whatnot. But just a word about fantasy, science fiction, and pop culture. We're at a threshold. I mean, it's not so much pop culture anymore. Science fiction and fantasy are just kind of culture. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King won Best Picture. We crossed that threshold, right? I mean, our highest cinematic art is Tolkien, right? You know, that's I don't know. Like, whatever. And so I don't know if this is really pop culture as much as culture, but bear with me. Three longish threads that I want to weave together here that are part of a larger project of mine, where I'm trying to track the science fictionization of fantasy, where fantasy kind of old school was wonder and fantastical things, but now we get codified fantasy, you know, the rules and everything. That's very kind of science fictional. And so this is part of that larger project. And I hope some folks in here have some feedback for me. So part one, brief history of magic systems. Part two, an LDS divinity of obedience. I tried to find a different word other than theology, because of course, you know, a theology of obedience tends to have connotations of like, God says you must do this and you must obey. But there's an oddity in Mormon theology around the idea of obedience where it's not just we who obey, everything obeys, right? And so we'll get to that. And then magic systems and fantasy authors. But first, I just want to zoom through a couple of these. 20th century fantasy begins with, you know, some really big names. H.P. Lovecraft, Ron Howard. No, I got that wrong. It's not Ron Howard. It's Howard, whatever. The guy who wrote Conan, that guy. Tolkien, Anne McCaffrey, which her fantasy in the 60s, the Pern series, Like, you think you're reading fantasy, and a few books in, you're like, holy crap, this is science fiction. If yeah, spoiler alert. The when there's, like totally, like, scientific explanations for the dragons and the weather and everything. It's not just all magic. But a couple of these beforehand. Lovecraft, his magic ended up just being kind of alien ruptures into our reality and, you know, madness-inducing. And Howard, that is his last name? I forget. But sword and sorcery, magic is highly mysterious. Mostly big, bad, evil people are magic and whatnot. Tolkien, though, magic takes on this good versus evil. But when you get into the Silmarillion, it's not really like magic. It's more like divine. Like, if you understand Tolkien's universe a bit more when you stop seeing Gandalf as a wizard and see him more as an angel, as, you know, this that the gods send down to help mortals and things like that. And McCaffrey, like I said, you know, a bit more rule-based. And then you get Piers Anthony, this wacky guy who writes... sorry, any Piers Anthony fans in here. Just horrible kind of trash fiction. But highly structured sort of reasons for why magic does the things it does in his fiction. In the Encyclopedia of Fantasy, John Clute, like, lists him as, like, that's now 15 years old, and so it's a bit outdated. But John Clute was like Piers Anthony, rule-based magic systems, junk literature is what he called it. But then you get Jack Vance, his Dying Earth series, which is, I guess if you want to technically call it, it's thousands in the future, post-apocalyptic, the Earth is dwindling and whatnot. But you get in his fiction this rules of magic that are very book-based. You know, you have a limited number of spells that you can figure out each day, and then you got to go relearn them again, and dwindling magic and whatnot. That is a surprisingly square peg, square hole version of the magic you find in Dungeons & Dragons in its first iteration. 40 years ago this year, Dungeons & Dragons as a game. 40 years ago. And Dungeons & Dragons, from the 70s to now, had its origins in minifig, kind of, you know, big kind of table strategy games and whatnot, and very rule-based. You know, if you ever open up a D&D rule book, it's, you know, charts with level one, you get this many spells, and they do these things. Like, spells are like ammunition or something like that, and wizards are like artillery and whatever. I mean, because it comes from that minifig kind of background. But it's difficult to overstate the role that Dungeons & Dragons had on an entire generation, you know, my age and a little bit older, and younger, of fantasy authors, especially in America and Europe. It's difficult to overstate the influence of Dungeons & Dragons on, you know, these formative years. And throw a dart at a board of names of fantasy authors that are writing today, and you're likely to hit someone who grew up playing Dungeons & Dragons. And there's two really cool articles. Just came out a couple of days ago. July 13th and July 16th. July 13th in the New York Times and July 16th in New Yorker. If you just Google Dungeons & Dragons New York Times or Dungeons & Dragons New Yorker, you get two really cool articles about how the game has influenced a bunch of different authors and things like that. Not even science fiction fantasy authors, like literary types. The rule-based kind of way of magic... I have a couple walls of text, forgive me here. Although these are from the Encyclopedia of Fantasy. Although notions of magic differ slightly from writer to writer, there's a remarkable consensus among fantasy writers, especially writers of genre fantasy. Magic, when present, can do almost anything but obey certain rules according to its nature. Particularly rationalized fantasy stories, in these stories, the laws of magic may be carefully codified, elaborate systems. And then there's this reference, or by using the laws of magic, divided by James Frazer, who is an anthropologist, Scottish anthropologist in the beginning of the 20th century. Anthropologists, they don't read the guy, poor guy, but literary types loved him. You know, high modernist folks like T.S. Eliot footnoted him, and a bunch of modernist thinkers just loved his expansive cross-comparison of religion and theology through the ages. And Frazer had this idea of, you know, magic down through the ages, you know, could be explained in two basic rules, that like produces like, and that things that have been in contact continue in contact even when they're separated. You know, those two themes kind of connect magic throughout the years. And then there's this, I should have put maybe that one first, Kenneth Burke. He's a rhetorician, theorist of language and whatnot. He picks up on Frazer's orders of rationalization. Frazer charted this you know, cultures, civilizations go, you know, first they explain things through magic. You know, if we do, we mix these sorts of things and do this kind of dance and whatnot, then things happen in nature. They just happen. A causes B. And then, from there, you develop into religion, which has this, what Kenneth Burke calls a propitiatory element, that it's more arbitrary. You know, we appeal to the gods who then, like, you know, control things for us and whatnot. And then science, of course, gives us control over technology, which then gives us control over our environment, orders of rationalization. The connection here for Burke, which I find a melding of all three of these orders of rationalization in fantasy magic systems, is this quote sums it up nicely. The magical and scientific rationalizations thus be distinguished by the assumption of universal regularity, which could be manipulated by the proper formulae, whereas religion stressed an arbitrary principle, which cannot be coerced but had to be propitiated, you know, appeal to the gods and whatnot. And so religion, let me sidestep a little bit into LDS, theology, scriptural, just the scriptures and Doctrine and Covenants. You have verse after verse after verse after verse about how the universe is run by laws and the nature is run by laws and God follows laws, I mean, over and over. You know, if there's a blessing we get, it's obedience to the law upon which it is predicated. I, the Lord, am bound when you do what I say. Oh, my goodness, God has to obey things, right? All who will have a blessing shall abide by the law, which is appointed. The law of Christ, or the light of Christ, fills all things, which is a law by which all things are governed. All kingdoms have a law. There's different spheres for these things. And it just goes on and on and on and on. This notion that laws govern things in different spheres of existence. Then you get this. I went digging through the Ensign just to find. And of course, that you can find a lot of awesome, quirky quotes by Brigham Young about how God is a god of laws, and if he not, he would cease to be God when he's quoting Alma and things like that. But then you get this awesome little article in 1980 in the Ensign by he was a BYU biology professor at the time, a dude named Kent Nielsen. Anyone know him? Neither did I. But you look through his article, and it's a study in kind of like, all I have is anecdotal evidence for this next claim, but it's a study in kind of this mindset of how Latter-day Saints kind of rationalize the ways that the natural universe works, right? You know, so he makes claims that that there's a mortal order of nature and an eternal order of nature, and that the same order set of laws does not necessarily extend to other spheres. Like a millennial world would follow different laws. I love this one. For instance, the biology of a world in which there is no death. The dude is writing fantasy literature right now in the middle of an Ensign article. He doesn't know he's doing it, but he's doing it. In the biology of a world in which there is no death, or try to fit the second law of thermodynamics, which states that all energy processes are running down, into a world of eternal progression. Man, that's a cool fantasy story, right? You know, science fiction or something, right? But that's what he's doing here, right? You know, different in sort of thinking through these different orders of rationalization or nature. And there's this quote, which I'll come back to, that, you know, but we get this element of propitiation. We're melding magic and religion and kind of God's technology all into this same idea. So magic, religion, and science all into this kind of notion that the same God who holds the world up in its orbit can also do miracles. But these miracles, however, may be the result of higher laws for our sphere that are not understood by us. So, right, you see here, right, the melding of all these kind of three different ideas. So let's switch back to fantasy.
Hey, you got 5 minutes.
Oh, and I'm done. No, just kidding. So Orson Scott Card, self-explanatory, he wrote the book on how to write science fiction and fantasy. Even though a bunch of people in the SF fantasy kind of writerly world now pan the book, it's the one that most science fiction fantasy writers start with. In it, he makes this claim: with magic, you have to be very clear about the rules, okay? Blah, blah, blah. Skip over that. Brandon Sanderson, full disclosure here, Brandon and I went to BYU together. We're on the staff of the Leading Edge or whatnot. This is a picture a little while ago. He and I ran into each other in the Chicago airport, cut up a little bit. I helped him, like, stock some shelves with signed books in the airport bookshelves, whatever. But Brandon, cool guy, very big in the fantasy lit world right now. Two Hugos, one of which is for his podcast, Writing Excuses, which is how to write stuff. That got Hugo for related work, the nonfiction work, last year. So, like, the science fiction and fantasy community looks to Writing Excuses as, yes, that is the standard of what we mean by, you know, how to write science fiction and fantasy. And he has these laws of magic. I just want to focus on this first one in the last 3 minutes I have. That author's ability to solve conflict with magic is directly proportional to how well the reader understands said magic. So Brandon sees this continuum or scale of, like, there's soft magic systems in literature that are more like Tolkien, you know, it's magic is big and it's out there and whatnot. You know, we're more concerned about the hobbits who are caught in the middle of the whole thing. But on the other side is hard magic, which is more Brandon's thing, which this is the side where, you know, explicit rules of magic, the magic itself is a character, and by showing off its laws and rules, the author is able to provide twists, world-building characterizations. If the reader understands how the magic works, then you can use the magic to solve problems. Magic becomes technology, another tool, right? And like any other tool, its careful application can enhance the character and the plot. And his own approach is, you know, magic systems easily explainable, but not a lot of behind the scenes. Characters have a good understanding of it. This is partially because, but they don't understand at all because I treat my magics like sciences. And I don't believe that we'll ever completely understand all the laws of science, this Mormon author says. So I took one of those last quotes from the Nielsen guy, and took out the word powers or miracles or God and just put magics in there. The same magics that hold this world in its orbit has the power to perform miracles, to make what appears to us to be temporary exceptions to the order of nature as we understand it. These magics, however, may be the result of higher laws for our sphere that are not understood by us. Now, this last claim, or this last observation, I'm not making a causal connection between, oh my goodness, Mormon theology has created fantasy magic systems or whatnot, but you have the most influential people now in American European fantasy genre making that come from this unique LDS background that are infusing their views, their backgrounds of universe and laws and whatnot into the ways that they articulate how laws ought to work in their magic, in their books. And I wish I could underestimate how influential this is right now among budding fantasy authors, but they're the main voices now. And so that's kind of the random onslaught of ideas here, and it's part of a bigger project, but I can answer more questions later. Thanks.
So what you're saying is that D&D influenced our generation of writers and D&C will influence the next generation?
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
Okay, come on.
All right.
You got it.
That was good.
We just sent this
in
the garbage.
A lot of graphic art, number one. But one of the things that I really love to do is to make jokes on the internet. That's why I'm famous. And I'm going to show some of those to you today and talk a little bit about my process. But I have a threefold mission to make jokes. And it starts with watching a lot of television. When I work, I like to listen to television shows and work my way through series and right now I'm working my way through Breaking Bad, and sometimes that informs the work I'm doing. So I watch a lot of television, love movies. I have teenagers who like me, and I really like them, which is good, because there's no murder happening. But we all get, these are not my teenagers, but anyway, we can get along. So they love to keep me up on what's going on. They, you know, this is funny, Mom. This is Mom. You'll find this funny. And it's true. I always do. So I have teenagers. And then I spend a lot of time on internet forums, like blogs, Facebook groups.
Was that you a couple years ago?
Me?
No. Half an hour ago.
That was me. So those three things combine to create this Venn diagram where right in the middle is where the Mormon meme magic happens. And so sometimes what will happen is I'll go into somebody will be talking about something online, or something will just pop into my head, a quote or an image, or somebody will say something, maybe somebody who's not on the more progressive side of Mormonism will say something that I think is ridiculous, and I want to flip the script on them. So I'll do stuff like this. So it's really unfortunate when there's no motherhood available to chaperone all the men that want to play basketball. So stuff like that. Right?
Hey, if you ever want to
out, doesn't it? Okay. Or this is one of my favorites. I took a bunch of Boyd K. Packer's quotes, and I felt like they needed a different face. So I combined them to create a new character I call Boyd K. Grumpy. And because a lot of what he says, really, I mean, you don't know who said it sometimes. A cat or an apostle? I have a series of these. That's my favorite. Actually, no, I think this one's my favorite. And anyway, a lot of what he said is just really... I keep all these in a folder on my hard drive called Evil Speaking. I figure if I ever decide to leave the church, which I don't, I'm an active, believing, faithful member, my poor bishop, but I'll just send him the entire file and say I'm out. So sometimes I come across a picture or a quote where I think there's some context that needed to be added there. I felt like that was really what was going on. And really, I mean, if you read between the lines of Elder Holland's quote, that's... Anyway, and then sometimes somebody will do something like this one in the middle, and I feel like, oh, no, we should maybe point them in the right direction. And I posted this in the... I want to say the BYU, a BYU group. The original meme came from them, and I went and posted it back, and it started... the biggest war of that week. But anyway, it was terrible. And this was, I think, right before Ordained Women was sort of a something that people were really talking about. So I was John Baptist. I prepared the way for you. And then this is another one of my favorites. If you're an Arrested Development fan, so sometimes I like to watch television shows and then combine them with scriptural stories because I feel like they work really well together. I mean, that really is the story of Nephi, right? Yeah. Let's see. Oh, that's not a very flattering picture. But it was the only one I could get that worked with that. Anyway, he feels the rug really pulls the room together. So, all right. And then sometimes I just love to view the art on LDS.org, and I like to make up my own captions for what is going on in the picture. So that's one of them. This is from the BYU. This is from the BYU archives. There's a lot of really good stuff in there. It's really hard to downloaded. That's a quote from the movie. Not familiar. And there's Elder Oaks.
The face is a great. Huh? The face is a great. I'm glad someone brought a computer. That was an angel.
There's plenty of duds. I'm so sorry. And then, oh, there's another one. Where let's see. And then one of the things that I like to do is sometimes I'll go into the FMH Facebook group and I'll say, I have this idea, feed me content. And I want you guys to give me ideas, or sometimes somebody else will spark an idea. And so we'll spend hours sometimes, and I just rapid fire create a template so I can just rapid fire throw these out. And it's very fun. And it's good skills for me, having to work so quickly and think and make decisions. So I enjoy it as an exercise, and I enjoy crowdsourcing some of this kind of stuff. So this is the next, the last bullet that here I'm showing you is this whole series that I did. I think 6 months ago, maybe, this was all in response to, you know, well, you obviously know because you can read. So we did these are all the things that people would say about why women shouldn't want the priesthood. So these were things that people had heard. So some of them are just I don't know, their brides are not very modest, I'm sorry. Just like it. I don't have a profile on ordaining women. I am a huge supporter and a very vocal and public supporter. So this is the kind of stuff I do to support them, and I love pointing out some of these discrepancies. So many meetings, guys. So many. Women just can't handle it. They're so delicate. Right.
You'd look great in a suit. You'd look great in a suit.
Thank you. Note to self. And then, so I do these whole series, and they're very fun, and I think we get a kick. And then I usually post them up on the blog the next day or so. I know. Yeah. And then. So, just so you know, that's a salad. It's based on a recipe from the children's friend. So, I don't know what you're seeing. But anyway, so that's my process, and it's something I find.
Did you film this yourself? Like, did you take this picture? Oh, she made the salad.
This is not one of mine, no. I am famous for the salad.
Okay.
A year ago, on my birthday, I had six elders showing up to my house, and I thought, I think I'll serve the canvas salad from the children's friend and videotape it and put it on YouTube with their permission. I'm not a monster. And then, that's what I did. And it was very. I mean, we got a minute. I can pull it up, I guess. Let's see. Ooh, I feel like I'm back in my stomping grounds. Yeah. How nice. actually just changed everything. So, we...
There are other candlestick salad videos?
No. Oh. I guess you're right. I guess I could just...
Content filter, content.
Yeah. Oh, what do you know? First hit. Okay. Let's see. Hold on. Let me pause it.
Oh, we don't have sound, though.
Oh, just point the microphone.
Yeah, I can do that.
There is a...
I gotta go to this side.
We had sound earlier. There's a cordless yeah. jack up there. You can just plug it into the mic.
We'd exercise your priesthood there, Ethan.
It's not working.
Sorry.
Alrighty, then. See if we can do it this
way.
Might have
to unplug the...
Oh, unplug that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you mean this kind of elders?
Oh, yeah. Oh, what is going on?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do. The
function.
Oh, your function key is held down. Okay, hold on. Now I'm holding F12. What?
F12.
F12? Okay. Okay, yes. Yeah, so they didn't know what was going on. That's my signing room. Well,
if you could answer every single question I have in here, then I would seriously consider joining the Mormon
faith. I love this guy in the corner because he carefully just moves them out of the way. At our house every time the missionaries come over, and if you don't do it, they're very disappointed. In fact, well, when the mission, we had one elder who was not a fan and ratted us out to the mission president, and they were not allowed to come to our house for 6 months. But, oh, they're back. So that is what I do, and I don't know that it's influencing pop culture or
I'd say so.
Detracting from it, but that is what I do.
All right, no time for questions, only time for lunch, but you know, we're all here. You can talk to us. Buy us lunch. Thanks, everyone.